The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and thank you for coming. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Paul Addis, and I'm an active supporter of the Free Library of Philadelphia and libraries in general. I'm also a member of our foundation board. If you haven't explored the Free Library, I encourage you to take the time to do so. Among other things, this library has a wonderful collection, including a special collection, including collections on automobiles, maps, unique music, and medieval manuscripts. It's quite spectacular, and I encourage you to take part. Before we begin, please take the time to silence your cell phones. In addition, let me let you know that following tonight's event, there'll be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. Books are for sale from the Joseph Fox Bookstore, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Free Library. David Eisenhower, our speaker, is the director of the Institute for Public Service at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication. Obviously, he is the grandson of the former president, Dwight D. Eisenhower. David's New York Times best-selling book, Eisenhower at War, previous book, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. I read Going Home to Glory, this book that David will speak about, and came away enriched with a greater appreciation of President, or General Eisenhower, as he preferred to be called in retirement. Frankly, I came away envious of David and Julie Nixon Eisenhower's intimate relationship with a man I would have liked to have met and studied with. For me, the book is a study in character. General Eisenhower was a man who understood the responsibility of great office, and he lived a life of service. I was struck by a quote David cites from the deceased journalist Hugh Seide about General Eisenhower. He writes, "It has been one of those mysteries of national life why all would-be presidents who have been frantically searching for some formula to catapult themselves to the heights of popularity have failed to study the example of Eisenhower. Perhaps in this age of contrivance, it is too simple to be believed. Decency, sincerity, and honesty. It shines out of Ike like a beacon. It illustrates anew that all programs espoused and bills passed and the billions spent are only a part of this thing of being president, and maybe even the lesser part in a time of dispirited affluence." It seems quite a relevant quote. Let me conclude by making my own personal reference. I want to quickly mention my remote connection to General Eisenhower. Most recently, my 92-year-old father died. An enlisted Army combat veteran of World War II, he never especially liked the Army, never spoke about his 5 years of active service, and was not a Republican. However, my father told me the story more than once of an early evening walk he took across the Columbia University campus in 1948 or 49, and I forget, while a student on the GI Bill, where he encountered Columbia's president, General Eisenhower, walking alone. My father paused and saluted, the corporal saluting the general. My father paused and saluted, and General Eisenhower said, "Good evening, soldier." My father was always an admirer of General Eisenhower, voted for him twice, and respected his wisdom. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome David Eisenhower.
Now, Paul, thank you very much for that summary. I was standing off stage and listening to that. That was really wonderful, and I appreciate it very much. Paul and Kathy, I'd like to say hi to the McCabes, old friends up here. Renee Moore, Art and Tanya Carey, I believe, are here. Art, thank you for that piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning. Bob McElhane, my oldest friend, here in the greater Philadelphia area. It's nice to see him again tonight as well. It is a real pleasure to be at the Philadelphia Free Library tonight to present Going Home to Glory. And I understand it is a tradition that I read from this book, and so I talked to Julie this morning, my whiff on this book, and she chose the pages, so I'll read them in a couple minutes. By way of background, I'd like to introduce this book. We have aspired to be writers a long time. In 1976, shortly after I got out of law school, we heard from a friend that there was some interest in us among publishers in New York, and Julie and I drafted a book proposal, and we circulated that to publishers in New York that summer, and the title of the book proposal circulated that summer was Going Home to Glory. So this has been a work that has been in progress for a long, long time. I have always wanted to be a writer. I can, as far as I can remember looking back over my life, I've always wanted to be a writer. And this is a book that draws on records at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library, as well as others, the Nixon Library and others. Thanks to the miracle of the records-keeping system at the Eisenhower Library, I think I'm one of the few published authors in America that can actually produce a copy of the first short story I ever wrote. I was age 10. I had a cousin by the name of Janet who lived in Chicago. She came east to Gettysburg to visit us at the farm. She made a huge impression on me, and I wrote a short story entitled Janet Stay. According to the so-called Whitman files, these are the files that Ancy Whitman, my grandfather's secretary, kept. She sat in the office adjoining the Oval Office where the president's secretary sits today. On July 15th, 1958, David, age 10, me, walked into her office, approached the president's secretary, and said, "Please type this up." And so Mrs. Whitman produced a copy of Janet Stay. We went over to one of these newfangled Xerox machines and ran off 10 copies of Janet Stay, my very first novel. And as it turns out, July 15th, 1958, was a good day to have 10 copies of your first short story on hand because Marines were landing in Lebanon. So the cabinet meets and recesses, the National Security Council meets and recesses. I put this short story on sale outside the Oval Office for 15 cents a copy. Went through a first printing in about 30 minutes. I also got what authors must have, and that is encouragement. One of my heroes would, as a boy, turn out to be my future father-in-law. I had never really met the vice president to talk with him, but suddenly that morning, I can remember, he was standing there in a gray suit, and he asked me what this was. I said, "This is a book that I have just written." He says, "It's for sale. How much?" And I said, 15 cents. His aide reached in his pocket, came up with the 15 cents because he didn't carry cash. 2 days later, I got a letter from the Vice President of the United States saying, "Dear David, after dinner last night, the family gathered in the living room for a reading of Janet Stay. Mrs. Nixon and the girls want you to know that we all agree you're one of our very favorite authors." So I got encouragement. We also feel that there is a story worth telling here. The topic of Going Home to Glory is presidents in twilight, or what follows the White House, elder statesmen. This is a topic which I think has been shortchanged by historians. There is a great book that many of my students at University of Pennsylvania read by Douglas Brinkley entitled The Unfinished Presidency, about Jimmy Carter. One of our favorite recent books is Candace Millard's River of Doubt, which chronicles the restless Teddy Roosevelt, a vivid personality, as he worked off the shock of his defeat in 1912 by hazarding an exploration of uncharted regions of the Amazon River Basin, almost dying in the process. This is a very interesting character study. And this is also a significant story in a country, our country, the United States, which under the 22nd Amendment requires its chiefs of state to step down after two terms, imposing limits on powerful and charismatic individuals who in most places in the world would govern indefinitely, I believe. And so Going Home to Glory, this chronicle, begins not with Dwight Eisenhower's inauguration or with birth. It begins with January 20, 1961, as expectant Washington throngs gather for the inauguration of John Kennedy. Meanwhile, in the snows that are blanketing the region, the Eisenhowers are making their way home to Gettysburg along a 70-mile highway lined with throngs, literally thousands of people, well-wishers holding signs, and they're returning to Gettysburg and their farm and our home, which was on the corner of the farm, for a family dinner that night to celebrate his return to Gettysburg. I remember that, and I recreate it in this book. This was a happy, sad evening. I can remember the toasts that night. The grown-ups got up and raised their glasses to the past and to the beginning of a new life. Now, in the years to follow, Dwight Eisenhower would not be leading an expedition towards a river of doubt, but he did have occasion to doubt. In 1961, power had been transferred to the opposition party, and Dwight Eisenhower could have a few illusions what the narrow defeat of 1960 meant for him, meant for his political legacy, and perhaps for the future of the country. Nor was he leaving an unfinished presidency behind, but he did have regrets. One of the things that my father told me as a boy that made a big impression on me, and I've always observed presidents with this idea very much in mind. He said to me, it is impossible to be a president of the United States or to exercise authority on that scale and leave office without regrets. All presidents have regrets, and Dwight Eisenhower did have regrets, and he had satisfactions as well. Going Home to Glory also covers unfinished business, and there was a good deal of unfinished business in the early 1960s. Berlin was a confrontation point between the free world and the communist world. Laos was the scene of a war that would evolve into the Vietnam War. Cuba was an ongoing problem that Eisenhower bequeathed to Kennedy. And because of these crises, Dwight Eisenhower, as a former president, will be drawn into support of and consultation with the incoming Kennedy administration, and he will consult President Kennedy in a very interesting way that I recreate, I believe, in Going Home to Glory. These are not two people that were friendly, because, after all, the Kennedy campaign in 1960 focused primarily on shortcomings and things that had not been done in the Eisenhower years. On the other hand, President Kennedy's extraordinary courtesy towards Dwight Eisenhower, I hope, really comes through in this book, as well as his respect and solicitation of Eisenhower's views, which was something that actually grew with time. By 1963, they are consulting fairly regularly. Now, from Gettysburg, Dwight Eisenhower observes the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I cover in this book, and this ushers in changing times. And as a teenager in Gettysburg, I am recognizing that the times are changing, as we all were, everybody my age. Dwight Eisenhower was deeply involved in 1963. He was leader of, he was in touch with the leadership of both parties that year as the civil rights situation comes to the forefront in America and as we begin to contemplate legislation. In 1964, he is involved with the Republican leadership as the conservative challenge led by Barry Goldwater appears. And as the Republican Party finds itself improvising for a formula to convert the core principles of this new conservatism, which is going to energize the Republican Party into some kind of winning formula. And we cover that in detail in this book. Vietnam starts in late 1964, and Dwight Eisenhower would emerge as a counselor to President Johnson as well. And it is his role as counselor in Vietnam, which I think is very easy and documented in great detail in sets of papers that we examined at the Eisenhower Library in Abilene. Dwight Eisenhower is, in short, an active man, but his life gradually, inexorably, becomes simpler and quieter in the pages of Going Home to Glory. All along, I am seeing the personal side of Dwight Eisenhower. Americans liked Ike in the 1950s. And a question that I guess that I was in a position to ask and answer to some extent in the 1960s was what was it that made him the leader and the person that he was? A president, a former president, is much easier to know than a sitting president. Which is one reason why I think the post-presidency should be covered in some books. Presidents, post-presidents are not scheduled minute to minute. They are not surrounded by coteries of aides and staff and cabinet officials. And we were neighbors at the time. I recall him in these pages as a general, a statesman, but also as a farmer, hunter, a painter, a golfer, a former ball player, a sage, a supervisor, and eventually, as he becomes more confined and as his health begins to fail, he becomes, I'm a companion and even a friend at the end. Maybe his role, knowing him in his in the role of supervisor or owner of the farm is one of the more telling and interesting, certainly one of the more vivid roles that I can remember him at. I started work at the Gettysburg Farm in 1958. I was age 10. That's the year I published Janet's Stay. I was working at 25 cents an hour. I was hired, and I thought that was doing pretty well. The Eisenhower Farm, by the way, is open to the public. It's about 110 miles west of here on Route 30 or Pennsylvania Turnpike. If you visit the Eisenhower Farm, please admire the fences. I painted them five times. We had ups and downs. I got off to a fast start at age 10. I worked there several summers and so forth. I began to lose my concentration somewhat. I relate one episode of the documents. That summer of 1963, I was 15, and a couple of the farmhands and I went past deadline over a lunch hour, and we were playing cards. We didn't know that the general was on the grounds. Suddenly he appears at the door and walks through the door, and anybody who experienced Dwight Eisenhower's temper would have probably kind of a similar story. I don't remember what he said exactly, but I did make out three words: you are fired. Well, we had a golf game that afternoon, and I wasn't sure what the fallout from this was going to be, and so I went home and I waited. And about 3:45, his car pulled up, so he was going to meet the date, and we rode in silence to the Gettysburg Country Club. We played the first hole, the two of us, in silence. We played the second hole in silence. On the third hole, he finally turns to me and he says, David, I allow my associates one mistake a year. You've had yours. By the fourth hole, I was rehired, proving that to err is human and to forgive divine. I was with him as in the 1960s as a process begins. Historians for 45 or 50 years, it's been very slow, but it's been very steady, have looked back with fondness and a certain nostalgia for the Eisenhower years. By the mid-late 60s, the period was being appreciated because of the peace and prosperity of the 1950s, the stability that Americans had in Washington. This is a long piece, to borrow a phrase from international relations, which provides a setting for innovation. America in the 1950s enters the space age, the computer age, the atomic age. We build an interstate highway system. We build thousands of schools. We adopt new living patterns in this country. Civil rights gets great impetus, and this is all advanced by wise and careful planning. He could take satisfaction by the end of the 1960s, and he would live to see a resurgent Republican Party in the Nixon victory in 1968. In 1961, as this book opens, Dwight Eisenhower had occasion, many occasions, to wonder if the pundits and the officialdom in Washington were correct in thinking that his presidency had been an anomaly. He's elected in 1952, the first Republican to be elected since 1933. Was this an anomaly? And he was conscious of the fact that many in Washington regarded the Eisenhower years as just that. He would live to know with certainty that the Eisenhower presidency was not an anomaly. It was a first. It was the first in a succession of Republican presidencies, which have become, became very common over the next 5 decades. Now, this Republican revival is how I ran into my with. Going Home to Glory is written with, by me, with Julie Eisenhower. Julie enters the picture in the fall of 1966. We had met several times in passing during the White House years, but we did not know each other at all. Before, by complete coincidence, she showed up at Smith College and I entered Amherst, 7 miles apart. My grandmother was aware of it. She was determined that we get together. I sort of resisted it. Finally, a Republican group in the area invited the two of us to make a joint appearance. We decided to coordinate our replies, so I called on her at Baldwin House, liked her instantly, asked her out for a dish of ice cream, discovered I'd spent all my money on the cab getting over there, so she picked up the tab the first time. Then I went back and had one of these sort of encounters that might have been a deterrent if I hadn't been curious and determined. Baldwin House had a Proctor system, and I can still see it. It was a night in November 1966. This senior was sitting there poring over biology texts, long straight hair, horn-rimmed glasses. I walked up feeling slightly self-conscious. I'm saying, I am David Eisenhower. I would like to see Julie Nixon. She gives me a long look and says, well, my name is Harry Truman. But I persisted, and so step by step, I was introduced into this new world. It was Dwight Eisenhower's world, but I had missed out on it as a child, the world of national campaigns and how they work and how the presidency takes shape in the course of a national campaign. To see how the issues of 1968 were connected to earlier issues, how the Vietnam War, for instance, of that time, and the Korean War of the Eisenhower era were connected in some way in the wider cause of ending wars for America in mid-20th century and winning the peace, which kind of brings me to the reading. I know that we are supposed to read here, and I proudly do. This is my assignment from with Julie. Julie suggested that I pick a passage from this period where we are all in transition. I am going off to college, which means that I'm older. I'm meeting, about to meet Julie. My grandfather, of course, is now a steady influence in my life, and the issues are that will carry through in 1968 and 69 are becoming quite intense. He writes me on May 20 to say that he will address my commencement at Phillips Exeter on June 12, 1966, quote, I am going to talk largely about character rather than education, professions, and so on. I have read a draft to your mother and father, and they thought it was okay, so possibly I'm on the right track. I assure you that I will make a great effort to avoid preaching. Well, that's what he wrote me just before he comes to Exeter. All right, well, here it goes. Sitting in the audience on graduation day, June 12th, I compared the scene before me with the memory of Granddad's visit in 1962. Then the autumn weather seemed to crackle in anticipation of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Eisenhower had been a curiosity, a magnet, a reassuring symbol of the kind of statesmanship that would bring victory in the Cold War, a good-natured opponent of the young president. Graduation 1966 was, like October 62, incomparably beautiful, but in a different way. Rich sunlight created a cathedral-like effect through the tall trees shading the commons where the outdoor ceremony was held. The ritual of graduation seemed inward and pensive, part wedding, part baptism, part funeral. In the audience were parents, restless little brothers and sisters, and babies crying at awkward moments. The program was designed to honor achievement and to inspire graduates with thoughts about the future. But in that ceremony, the guests and students were facing an uncertain future, and the speeches highlighted the familial and the protective bond among Exeter graduates. Vietnam dominated everybody's thoughts. Granddad's theme was indeed character. He told the graduates, now suppose that we liken the career of an individual to a house, a lifetime house built of his own deeds, words, mistakes, and accomplishments, growing continuously through the years until the day comes when the final piece is fixed firmly in place and the occupant lies down at last to rest. If the house is to be strong rather than weak, beautiful instead of mean, useful instead of worthless. Its foundation must be sturdy and solid. You will recall the biblical parable of two houses, one built upon sand, the other upon durable rock. When the winds and floods struck them both, the one was demolished and swept away. The other, on rock, withstood every shock of wind and wave. The building blocks, he said that day, of character were hard work, worthy ambition, loyalty, common sense, integrity, and moral courage. He spoke of the continuum in American history that posed my graduating class with similar challenges and unavoidable responsibilities to those that had fallen on his West Point class 50 years earlier. He cautioned the graduates against influence that would lure them away from the values that mattered most. He stood solidly with the leadership that was asking the country to sacrifice in Vietnam. Grant did not mind sounding old-fashioned. He did not address the subjects that electrified campus life that spring: dissent, Cold War revisionism, black power, or even his own farewell address. His talk was a reminder that there is no escaping a clash between the values of his generation and the amorphous, mushrooming community coming to life across the nation's universities. My sister Anne had a similar experience. A year later, Granddad addressed her commencement at the Shipley School in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. As at Exeter, he spoke about the essential character traits of sound citizenship, concluding, "He startled Anne and delighted the audience of female prep school students with a Victorian thought. Remember," he said, referring to the miniskirts coming into fashion around the country, "ankles are always neat, but knees are always knobby." Dwight Eisenhower was proud of the commencement addresses at Shipley and Exeter. He had the latter reproduced and sent to several friends and referred to it frequently in answering public correspondence that questioned the student revolt and campus dissent against the war. In Waging Peace, that is his second volume of memoirs, he had made it clear that he believed that student unrest and other social problems would be resolved in time, and that freedom in an orderly society would endure. In Afterthoughts, he had written, "The great ideas of the West will continue their outward journey in concentric circles until one day they cover the entire globe. Our cardinal concepts of human dignity, of free enterprise, and human liberty will become so strong that as they crash against the conflicting currents of communism, they will overcome and demolish dialectical materialism and the ideology of regimentation." Well, that is my assignment, and that is concluded. I should add another thought, and that is not only did we want to do this book, not only do we feel that this book should be done, Julie and I felt that we needed to do this book. There is an Eisenhower legacy, which is of interest and importance to the public and the country, but I think equally important in all of our lives are the legacies that we leave in our relations with one another. Art is here tonight, and Tanya, thank you again for that wonderful article this morning. In our interview, and we met in our home several weeks ago, Art brought a book that his family had written about his grandparents. I have encountered this a number of times over the years. That is, families will get together and they will combine tributes and they will publish and put together these beautiful tributes to people who make differences, big difference in their lives. And I believe that there is a deep need to acknowledge such people, and this is a need that we certainly felt in putting together this book. There is no effort in Going Home to Glory to alter the historical image of the general of World War II. There is no effort to alter the historical image of President Eisenhower. Our purpose is to expand on these images and to make a record of other times that he should be remembered for as well, times when it was possible to know him, to receive his advice regularly, his tips for healthy living, to appreciate his guidance and support, to appreciate his enthusiasms, to see the personal example he set of serenity and faith by his frank acceptance of his limitations and his infirmities as time went on, to know his optimism, to see how it affected others, to try to understand what it was that enabled him to shoulder such responsibility in his life, and to appreciate his profound faith in the future and in America's future. and so we made a record of it. In answer to the question, why was he a great man, I think the answer in these pages is, quite simply, he's a great man because he was a good man. He was a good man in minor things and in big things, in public and in private. So I want to thank you for having me here tonight, the Philadelphia Free Library. I love libraries. We use them a lot at University of Pennsylvania. A library and one that is available to the public is one of the most important resources a community can maintain. It houses history, and this is a book of history. And I would say one thing about the study of history, whether it is history of politics or history of communities or history of business, and whether it is in the form of prose or whether it is in the form of novels or in a memoir, plays a very special role in our society. It cannot guide us in the future, and I'm paraphrasing President Kennedy. History does not provide a precise guide to the future, but it enables us to have confidence in the future. And the record, I think, of America and the record in this building is something that in all times, and these are not good times, even in troubled times, we can feel great assurance, I think, that as a free people facing challenges such as the ones we face today, that our future will be better than our past. Going home to glory also makes a final point, which I would mention or reemphasize. It may seem strange that the nation, which has assumed the leading role in world affairs, our nation, imposes time limits on its chief of state, which effectively builds in discontinuity in personal and institutional leadership in this country. We actually build in discontinuity. I think this story serves as an indirect reminder, at least, that continuity in America is a continuity of ideals and beliefs, of faith and free actions by leaders of, at many levels, in many communities. And Dwight Eisenhower is portrayed in these pages as somebody who assumed many roles in life and functioned as a leader at many levels, as so many Americans do. American history as a whole is a broad highway that points to the future, and those fortunate enough, and we are fortunate as Americans, we are building this highway and we ride along it on a path to glory indeed. It is often said that the 1960s was a great time to be alive, so it is today, and so it will be in the days to come, but for us, this fall, November and December 2010, is the exact right time, we feel, to tell this story. And so I appreciate this chance to be here tonight to present Going Home to Glory. Thank you.
David, thank you for that introduction to your grandfather. If you have any questions, please raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. Morris, right here in the second row, is coming to you.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library and for that excellent talk. Could you chat a bit about the relationship between Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower from 61 to 69?
I sure can. You're sitting next to Jay Riley, I guess a classmate of mine who was present for that commencement. In June of 1966, Jay, great to see you. Eisenhower and Nixon, this is an important story here. This is something that Julie could help me with a great deal. In fact, I think one of the, I would say, gems in this book, we have some wonderful sources. Because I got sent away to school, I actually... wrote letters home and received letters from home. And so by coincidence, I had a wonderful correspondence with my grandfather in this period, and that is one of the sources that we draw on. We have his diaries and so forth. One of the great sources I think that we tap in this book is a extraordinary chronicle that Julie made of the 1968 campaign. And we are engaged in late 1967, before we were 20, and we got married at the age of 20. And so her chronicle covers our daily activities, and it also covers my grandfather in very key ways, and also covers this relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon. There are several, I think, dimensions of it. One is it's easy. We're approaching 50th anniversaries. We look back on the Kennedy presidency, and I think we can all appreciate what was accomplished in that presidency in the early 1960s. What I try to recreate in this book is what it was like for Republicans to lose a 50-50 election, the pall of that defeat, the sense that one more thing done could have made a difference, and to understand certainly the short-range consequences and price and the price of a defeat that might have been avoided. This creates a very powerful bond between the outgoing president, Eisenhower, and Richard Nixon, the vice president, who had almost won that election. Whether he had indeed lost the election, that is, if you run a 50-50 race, generally you get credit for having at least gotten a tie, that forever influenced Eisenhower's judgment of Nixon. He did not think that Nixon had been a loser. Nixon had a loser image going into 1968. In fact, what Eisenhower appreciated is that Nixon and Kennedy both polled more actual votes in 1960 than Eisenhower had in winning a landslide in 1956, and so he appreciated his political skill. But above all, they had a great deal in common. They had a political legacy at stake. That is what I recognized about Julie immediately when I met her at Smith. Where has this person been all of my life? We have so much in common. And what we had in common is that we both left Washington on January 20th, 1961. So there is this sense that we need to try this again, and we need to get it. We need to succeed this time in 1968. That was a bond, and it is why Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower felt that Nixon was capable of winning, and he did not discard him in the 1960s when many others had. Now, the other is that there is a relationship between the two, which is a very interesting one. And I think that it is the subject, by the way, of a major book which is being researched right now. My wife and I just met with the author at Penn. We went to lunch with him on Penn's campus. And I think that it has always been sort of phrased incorrectly. People ask whether Eisenhower was a good boss and an understanding boss, and whether Nixon was a good subordinate and a loyal subordinate, and how did they interact. The boss-subordinate thing is really, it seems to me, incidental to the real story, which is Eisenhower was elected to the presidency twice. Nixon was elected to the presidency twice. These are twice elected presidents interacting for an interval in their lives in this supervisor, subordinate type role. But otherwise, they are people who are on their own trajectories and so forth, as two twice elected presidents are. It is a relationship that has a dynamic, much like a relationship that Dwight Eisenhower had earlier in his life, and that was with his superior officer in the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s, Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur had this major on his staff by the name of Eisenhower. And this major is somebody that is working in a staff capacity. And at one level, MacArthur is called upon to evaluate this person as a staff officer and to use him as one. But by the end of the decade, he had pushed Eisenhower out. And Eisenhower had difficulty accepting that, because he didn't understand it wholly. And he was pushed out, accompanied by a letter from MacArthur to the War Department saying that when war breaks out, and it will, this officer should be placed in immediate command responsibility. In other words, what MacArthur understood about Eisenhower is that he was not a staff personality, he was a command personality, and they were not going to mesh in the situation that was developing in the Far East in which MacArthur could anticipate taking command. So there are accounts between Eisenhower and Nixon of friction, misunderstanding, perhaps criticism or whatever, but Nixon was the first vice president to become an heir apparent. in national politics, meaning he's very important, Vice President. In fact, as a very young man, he is somebody that was more important to the Eisenhower administration than I think he even appreciated. He was the link between that administration and the Republican Party. Presidents cannot govern without the support of a party. Nixon provided that link. And he became aware of his own power in time, and as he did, I think perhaps an older and a wiser Eisenhower understood the need for a certain amount of independence, and they met as in the final sections of Going Home to Glory, they meet for the first time as true equals when Richard Nixon had been elected in his own right in 1968.
Right here in the front row.
In the book, during these years, there are many people who come in and out to visit the former president. But for the most part, they are people who weren't of military background that he had known. Is there anything to be taken from that? There doesn't seem to be a lot of generals and officers coming on a friend basis.
That's a good point. Well, now that you mention it, there was a pattern. I think that he saw less of the generals in the post-presidential years, and he saw more of the generals during the presidential years. For instance, we spent a lot of time at Augusta. We spent Thanksgivings and we spent Easters at Augusta National down in Georgia. By the way, Dwight Eisenhower has been chosen for the International Golf Hall of Fame. I tell golf stories. He had a great temper on the course. I wondered why he loved the game. He was often so angry out there. He was very serene, by the way, when he's having an actually bad round. He was very angry when he was having a good one. But he's somebody who popularized the sport in a big way, and he's been recognized, and I'm sure he'd be very proud of that distinction. But I have pictures in Augusta of Field Marshal Montgomery. He was a visitor several times. De Gaulle was a visitor a number of times in the 1950s. Galt, who was a military aide in World War II, was a visitor in the 1950s often. Bradley was a visitor occasionally. So I remember these generals when my grandfather was president. Then after he leaves the White House and goes up to Gettysburg, more political people for some reason. I think it's because of the Republican Party situation at the time. The titular leader of the party was Nixon, but Nixon is running for governor in 1962, so he's not available for the off-year elections. Eisenhower, therefore, as a former president and the reigning name in the party, was drawn into the 62 off year. He's drawn into the 64 kingmaking. And so you have a lot of cabinet people, a lot of political names in the guest book. And then as the years go by, you begin to see a lot of names repeated, a lot of Gettysburg names, and friends of his that helped either with the Eisenhower Farms or shared an interest in cattle or something simple like farming. Louis Strauss comes to mind. He'd been a Secretary of Commerce. He'd been chairman of the Atomic Energy, AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission. And Strauss and Eisenhower had endured Strauss's rejection by the Congress for confirmation of Secretary of Commerce in 1959, and that was a cause celebre in the Eisenhower administration and something that a sadness that they both shared, but they shared a great passion, and they loved Angus cattle, and Strauss had a major farm in Northern Virginia, and the Eisenhower farms, they were constantly forming partnerships. Strauss was around all the time. So people who were involved in his activities, and then his dearest and closest friends, George Allen and Freeman Gosden, the radio personality, I cover them and my experiences with them. I think what happens, life gets simpler, and the Army was a long time ago, and politics is more recent, and so the politicians are there, 61 through 65 or 66, and then that falls off, and eventually he's surrounded by friends and family.
Right here in the fourth row, lady in the red.
Towards the end of your grandfather's administration, President Eisenhower said, beware of the military-industrial complex. Given today's situation, where we are engaged in at least two wars, Could you tell us what you think your grandfather would say, amplifying that statement?
Well, it's very hard to say what he would recommend specifically, but since you raised the speech, I think it's one of the real highlights of the Eisenhower presidency. There's a poll of rhetoric professors in the year 2000. I mentioned this poll to my classes at Penn on presidential speech. I teach that subject there. And here's an interesting fact about the speech. I'll just respond to this briefly with what I think that speech is about. On January 17th, 1961, 72 hours before Going Home to Glory opens, Dwight Eisenhower gives a farewell address. And he warns the nation against the unwarranted acquisition of influence by a military-industrial complex. This is ranked as one of the 10 greatest speeches by rhetoric professors given in the 20th century by an American. 72 hours later, John Kennedy gives a speech rated even higher by rhetoric professors of the 20th century, which is an inaugural. Two of the 10 greatest speeches delivered in the 20th century delivered within 72 hours of each other. The temptation is to join them and to see how they argue back and forth and how they interact. And, in fact, they're very different speeches, which is what makes them great. What makes the Eisenhower farewell a great speech is it is the greatest farewell ever given by an American president. And as a farewell, in the evolution of the speech drafting, and I've actually looked at the speech drafts, you can see how this idea crystallizes in the Eisenhower administration. The impulse is to look forward, to warn the nation against overreacting to crisis, in effect, in a very oblique way, warning the nation against his successor. What happens in the course of drafting is that his gaze, which is forward, turns back. And in a farewell, the idea is to gaze back over your public career and to extract from that lessons that are timeless, not forward-looking, but timeless. And so Eisenhower, in the drafting of the speech, which unfolded over a period of about 6 months, in that speech, meditates on the great riddle of the 20th century that confronted his leaders and associates. And the riddle was this: how can industrialized society experience the kind of technological progress and growth as ours did in the first 60 years of the 20th century, hand in hand with the greatest tragedies humankind has ever seen? World War I, the Great Depression, World War II. This race between technology and catastrophe is something that confronted the leaders of his generation. And his conclusion was that Americans, or that the warning of Europe to free peoples everywhere else, is that totalitarianism took root in the 1930s because the people of European countries ceased to be citizens. What they did was they ceded control over their lives to others and stepped out of active participation in the affairs of their countries. They ceased to be citizens. And so what this warning is, or what this is a call to be a citizen. Improve yourself. Educate yourself. Become a better person. Become self-reliant. But above all, be involved. Be involved in government at every level. Be involved in every decision that has any bearing on your life. Be involved. Speak up. And insist that people who would assert some sort of basis of expertise or some superior knowledge as a basis for governing you, insist, or remember always, they work for you. The government always works for you. So it's a call to be a citizen, and it is a timeless thing. What happens in the Kennedy inaugural is quite similar, actually. The weight of Kennedy, the advice given to John Kennedy during the transition period concerning his inaugural, and in fact we have a project on it this semester, and I was just looking at the documentation this afternoon in a conference before I came over here. But I had known this. The weight of the recommendations that Kennedy was receiving was that since this election was a 50-50 election and you have a divided nation, we need to present a united front. And so you have to begin the speech by promising continuity, seeking unity, praising Eisenhower, pledging continuity on all these things and so forth. And then finally they understood what the true responsibility President Kennedy had, and that was to lead the nation and to point it forward, not to praise Eisenhower, but to lead the country forward. And so what happens in the later stages of that speech is that instead of looking back, they look forward. And so you have these two speeches within 72 hours of each other, back to back. One looking backward, phrasing a timeless message, the other looking forward, achieving a timeless effect. But one is an inaugural and one is a farewell. What Dwight Eisenhower would say about today is, it's just a general principle. Are Americans involved in school boards, in their local governments, with zoning councils? Do you improve yourself to assume control over your lives and to remain self-reliant? That's the real moral of this, and this is what went wrong and accounted for the great tragedies of the 20th century in his estimation. I don't know what he would say about anything in particular today. It is a long time ago. He would say about intervention, as a soldier, he had a strong sense that when Americans go abroad, they are a long way from home. Our missions, therefore, should be distinct, and in war situations, it is humane as well as practical necessary that the leadership understand that it is committed, that the armed forces are committed to the quickest possible resolution of armed conflict when possible. This comes up throughout Vietnam. Eisenhower is constantly urging Johnson to consider proposals by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so forth to accelerate the military effort to force this war to a negotiated or even a victorious conclusion. On the other hand, he understood at some level the complexity of President Johnson's position, and so while he urged this course privately on Johnson, he did not take issue with Johnson publicly, and in fact they were fast friends and great mutual support one to another throughout that period. Dwight Eisenhower understood that these simple formulas don't always apply in all situations, and so he's not talking about all situations in the speech.
Gentleman right here in the beige jacket.
You mentioned that you've seen various drafts of the Eisenhower farewell speech, and I've read that in the original draft, the reference was to the military-industrial congressional complex.
Actually, yes.
I was wondering how, if you know how the editing process went.
Well, in fact, you've pointed out there was a drafting process. In fact, there is new information that has just been released by the Eisenhower Library on the metamorphosis of that speech. It was planned as early as summer of 1959, which is a year and a half before he left office. In fact, many of Eisenhower's speeches from summer of 59 through 1961 were part of a program where he would address himself to a series of national issues that he felt not only as a Republican leader but as a president that he felt Americans should think about. In the later drafts of the military, of the farewell address, January 17th, in the later drafts, there are paragraphs that enumerate all kinds of complexes. There is a military-industrial complex. There is a scientific, technological elite. There is one elite after another complex listed. What he's referring to here is the interdependence and the specialization of life. He's talking about citizenship. And citizenship has changed. He's not sure what citizenship is, but he knows what is different about it. He grew up in Abilene, Kansas at the turn of the 20th century when most Americans were farmers. He came from a poor family, but they were self-sufficient. Today, We live in an interdependent world where we draw all of our necessities from places we have never visited. We all interact in a workplace. We are all tossed together in a society which places a great premium on trust. And trust means self-reliance, a willingness to step forward, defend yourself in public, much in the manner of Greek citizens. There are plenty of precedents for this in history, but the nature of citizenship in the United States has changed. And we are bombarded by expert advice. We are bombarded by the claims of people with superior expertise to have some special reason to give us guidance. And in the final analysis, I think what he's saying is that citizenship is hard and it is demanding, but it is, in the final analysis, simple. And it's as simple as just being master of your own fate. The Kennedy inaugural is also about citizenship, interestingly, which is its timeless quality as well. It paints a different, it provides or it offers a sort of romantic idea of what citizenship can be in terms that are consistent with the farewell address. It is interesting that these two speeches, now exactly 50 years ago, occur in such close proximity one with the other, and that, but they should be remembered for very different things. Kennedy's is the model of a young president taking authority and pointing an administration toward the future, and Eisenhower's as a model farewell and unifying address and discourse on the lessons of a lifetime delivered by an outgoing president.
I think we'll have to leave it with the lessons and responsibilities of citizenship. Please join me in thanking David. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.